Yeah, hello.
Hello. So this is the track one from Yuki Higashino, and it's called Kafka's Fable. It's track one was also, it was a piece by Vibeke Bachmann. The title, basically this project, just briefly to introduce it, it's a project that basically it's a collaboration between musicians and the artist Yuki. And what happened was he recorded the kind of 20 individuals' readings of an English translation, which is called A Little Fable by Franz Kafka. Each recording had been turned into a sheet of music via an audio MIDI converter. He then contacted musicians to play some or all of these 20 tunes. He asked the musicians to perform the music with improvisational interpretations, to develop them in their own musical languages using original scores as starting points. So number one, that was the musician was also, it was kind of played with temple blocks and cowbells, and it's by Luisa Markson. Okay.
Yeah, hello, Tris von Michel.
Yes, that's right. Hello.
You're from Glasgow?
England, but studied in Glasgow and spent some years there, yeah.
Born in Essex.
Born in Essex, of all places.
Yeah. Could you remember the time when you started to think about becoming an artist?
I was 8 years old, and I was always quite kind of hermetic and liked to just like draw and be in the corner and kind of avoid most kind of collective social contact in primary school. And I used to do watercolor paintings, and then one day the teachers, they collected all the watercolor paintings from different kind of schools in the county, or nearby schools anyway, at this exhibition in the Beecroft Gallery in Westcliff-on-Sea. And to my surprise, they selected one of my paintings when I was eight. So that was my first exhibition, which was probably a bit of tongue-in-cheek, really, a bit of a joke. But it was lovely because after that point, that was the first time I felt certain, you know, this is what I want to do, even if it meant being very hermetic and, you know, just watercolor paintings. And I still paint watercolors, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you started to study art, and is this something if you're doing performances or mm-hmm. What has this now to do with your or how is it related to your work you are doing now?
Watercolor painting.
Yeah.
The main relationship between
just yes.
Between watercolor painting and what I do now is it's really about kind of deliberation and a translation process, really. But I do watercolor paintings as a part of one project, which is the Finding Chopin, Search of Holy Quail project. And one of the main kind of themes in this whole work was about translation and different methods of translation and how that can be incorporated in daily activity. And so watercolor painting was also another translation that was very much a banal daily activity. But it wasn't much about the visual end product, much more about the process and just taking more and more kind of material entities into a new form and then trying to work with that, or at least trying to perform the new material entity.
New entities. And you started, you came for some months, I think, to the Städel School
mm-hmm.
here in Frankfurt. And at the Rundgang, you showed mm-hmm. a performance which was a kind of interaction or a presentation of a project. But what project was it?
The project at the Städelschule was called, here comes my bad German, Mini Mono Opa für Kindheitstrudel. And I always say Trudel and everyone doesn't really know what I mean, but I think
Trudel.
Wie Trudelmarkt, oder?
Trudelmarkt, ja.
Genau.
Flohmarkt.
Ja. Yeah.
Aber Trudel, ja, das ist ja so.
Ja.
Okay, das war also der Kindheitstrudel, mhm. die Mini-Oper. Und mhm. was genau ist dann diese, was geht es da genau?
For Städelschule, the idea was that I had these kind of projects that, I've only really worked on three projects and they're all interrelated. And then I realized at a point, maybe a couple months ago, that it's more of an operatic piece of work in many respects, but in not the true sense of the opera, but in a very traditional kind of almost degenerate form of opera that basically over the centuries became more and more elite as opera, but as a kind of a raw foundation beginning, which was this idea of a man who or a woman, anybody who is a performer, in which they have an assemblage of material, whatever that is, and their job is to somehow to perform, to entertain many things simultaneously, incorporating many different environments. And this was this kind of almost dangerous play, because this is what you'd be performing to, like, monarchs and stuff, and to the kings, and if you do this wrong, or if it's not liked, that's your head gone. But I quite like that that risk factor, and almost that overload of information. But unlike that kind of sense, like a 15th or 16th century opera, in that kind of the raw sense, I preferred more or less for it to be one-on-one intimate, or at least if it's not one-on-one intimate, maybe with two people, or at least the group is a collective yet intimate group in which there is a real, at least perceptible kind of dialogue that I can engage with. And for example, the experience performing the radio, that was eliminated, that engagement with people, and that was a huge problem, because that was, I realized that the importance of that for me was to also to make eye contact and to see, or to enter this world with the people and not just present or communicate this world.
And what is the meaning if you communicate with eye contact or something with people who are coming into a space, into an art space? Where's the difference if people are coming into a space which is wie sollte man das sagen? Yeah, which has a kind of was sozusagen als Art Kontext, als Art, also Kunstraum konnotiert ist.
I mean, I think the difference between perhaps performing one project on the radio for 1 hour and then performing for 7 hours on one day in a Städelschule or in an institutional framework of a cultural framework, the difference is actually it's very minimal. There's not a great difference, but the most important thing that kind of distinguishes the two factors is that there is actually, even if it's a strenuous activity, even if I've got to be in the space for 7 hours, there is a certain kind of a leniency. I can come in and out of that world, and it's never proclaimed that I'm a performer, that I'm a storyteller, that I'm actually doing anything to activate this work. It's very much based upon a social contact. Now, with the radio, the framework is proclaimed immediately by the medium, because it says, okay, at 3 p.m. you're introduced, there's a deadline time, because it's a structured thing, like as a radio broadcast. And at the same time, the listeners of perhaps Radio X or particular radio stations, there is already a kind of identity that belongs to that time slot, that my performance, the listeners, and this framework, the radio, that presents it. There's something it is a kind of a setup. It's an identity that belongs collectively in some way. Like people who go to the Rundgang are either going to be people who are related into the arts, interested, or family members of the students, and, you know, collectors, buyers. So fundamentally, there's not a lot of difference. But, you know, that was also difficult for me at the Rundgang, having to perform in that framework. There was a lot of things that was wrong with that.
What was wrong?
First of all, it distorts my role. My role becomes almost too precious, as if I need to physically be there to activate the work. And that's, in one respect, it's very beautiful. That I think that's good. But in the other respect, me as a performer, so to speak, that's exhausting and that's draining, and therefore it questions the longevity of the work. How long can I do this for? You know, is this something, because, you know, if it was paintings or other works or even sculptures or installations, they could be kind of set up in 10 years' time, more or less, with the right notes and information, whether I'm alive or not. But it makes it, the relationship between my biography and the work, it makes it so intense that it's a struggle to keep it, to really agree with how easy am I, basically. Am I that dispensable? Can I just be thrown here and there? And what if people wanted me to perform one week there and the next week there? Do I, like a sheep, will I follow the work? And then it questions as well, you know, am I interested in a more broad width readership or audience? And that, for example, the radio, absolutely, that was kind of an underpinning point that said I wasn't interested in that. For me to to have an opportunity to use the medium of radio to kind of convey a project to more people is fundamentally very, very much, it's unrewarding. That's not the goal of the work, and that's not also, and it also completely shifts the meaning of the work. And therefore, there are these kind of things that played a huge role. But both in radio and, that, for example, an installation in a cultural framework like an art gallery or you know, Rundgang, for example, I'm not saying that there's a huge difference between the two of them necessarily when it comes to, you know, this idea of message and meaning, or me physically having to be there and what I want to achieve by being there.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. But it's always an interesting question, what is a meaning of an artwork? So how do you feel by doing this, performing? When did you realize that you have a special way to express a kind of story, that you are able to tell a story in different ways?
I think it's a mixture between being more or less brought up with a photographic background. I mean, not just, I did a degree in photography in Glasgow, so there was already an overload of visual narration and a certain kind of, you know, photographic discourse that I couldn't really fully accept. And even though there were many forms of photography that was very interesting and in one respect just aesthetically pleasing, I was always taking kind of images with slides. I was always interested in analog slide photography. And what happens, I'd present it and, you know, be on a carousel and go around, and I always have to be there to maintain. So basically the mechanism of presentation, the slide thing, is like a child. You have to always come maintain it, make sure to change the lens. Whereas if it was a flat, kind of two-dimensional object, like a photograph you put on the wall, that relationship is already gone. So even the most subtle notion of a performer is gone. So if you take photography, you've got light-based and then paper-based. So you've got it on the wall. You as the artist, as the creator of that image, even the slightest kind of nuance of performer interactivity is gone, because you put it on the wall, you're gone. But the minute, if I am now just going to present a slide carousel, immediately the connotations kind of, with, I guess, domestic senses, the carousel, it goes around, and it's almost like, you draw the curtains, you're at home, you come back from your trip to Cyprus, and you know, your dad says, okay, children, we're going to show a kind of slide reel, and you go, oh, God, how many carousels? Four carousels, that means 80, that means it's 240 images. Oh, and it's like, and here is the beach, and here is the hotel. And there's this almost, I mean, I was told when I was at art school that slides, they're vulgar. Rough. Mm. They're rough. It's a rough form of photography in some ways, because even though it's exquisite, the light, the kind of the intensity, the colours, what you can gain with it, the form of presentation's rough. It's you know, fundamentally, you have to perform the mechanisms. You have to perform this slide carousel. It's clunky. It's noisy. And now we have these digital media where slide works doesn't necessarily need to feature so strongly, but I definitely disagree with that. I think that slide photography is really interesting, but at the same time, when I was at art school, I was happy just to show kind of slide works, and everyone was saying, what the hell is going on here? And they demanded a narrative, because immediately the photograph now becomes a photograph within an installation, and it suggests perhaps my presence as the person, the creator, because I have to be there anyway to kind of focus and to always, whereas a 2D image on the wall never demanded that. So that's why I think through photography education, I realized that, okay, and a lot of the tutors and friends said, Tris, just tell us a story. What are these images about? Which is kind of absurd, because I wouldn't say to someone on the wall, say, look, you've put that photograph on the wall, tell me everything about it. But because the way my presentation of the image is so demanding as well, that I needed to perform the narratives inherent to the work. So that's how it started. And then also it was probably because of a silence from my family. Both my mum and dad didn't really open up that much about particular histories. So I became interested in the idea of storytelling, and I researched it and thought, well, okay, this is going to be something that I'm going to explore in relation to my photographic interest.
Mm. And your father was a friend from Henri Chopin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The sonic memory, yeah. Artist.
Concrete poet, sound poet, very much a kind of, I'd say maybe you could say, a Dadaist artist in many forms and spanning through many different decades. So it's Fluxus, Situationism, you know, concrete poetry, sound poetry, kind of alternative modes of kind of for publishing and, you know, just generally what I'd say you'd call a good artist, really.
Who, Henry?
Henri Chopin, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your father is Eric
mm-hmm.
Twiss. Eric von der Michel.
Yeah, yeah. But Eric,
could you explain his name, please?
I have no idea about where it's from, or you know, it's a complete enigma.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry to be vague, but it's that's the truth. It's an enigma to me as well.
Mm-hmm. So, and what kind of works did your father? Oh, is your father an artist?
To some extent, but I'm not really too sure what kind of works he... I've got an idea of what he did, but this is one of the things that's... I think it's a really important aspect that I've always taken into consideration, which is always the notion of whether my responsibility is to communicate, and therefore... For example, the works that he may have made completely contradict a kind of a global philosophy of communication, whether we should be making works that communicate and whether the role of an artist is actually to communicate. And I think...
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that was always something that philosophically I think he always had a very peculiar and very interesting stance upon. And I think that was... It's also featured with me as well, because now that I'm perhaps more... I'm communicating more, should we say, my work. The more I do it, the more I oppose it. The more I question, is that really what I want to do? Am I really wanting to have 1 hour to storytell to more people? What is the advantage in that? Or do I actually want to have a bigger, more comfortable institutional framework to perform once more? And is this really where I feel progression lies in my artistic production? And I question, I say, I don't think so. I don't think that that's the illustration of my work becoming stronger or of my identity. You know, perhaps my identity as an artist becomes stronger when you actually have these opportunities, these cultural frameworks, when they're happy to present you more often. But fundamentally, as far as what my goal is and what I think where my development is, it had nothing to do with perhaps pouring the Städelschule that was awkward, or on the radio it was also awkward. And I think the works that my father made were very much questioning of these awkward spaces, but to the extent that even the documentation, even the kind of the realization of these events, these projects that he made, even that could not be communicated in a cultural forum, such as, you know, it wouldn't be something you'd find a review of, it wouldn't be advertised. These notions of communication, of contact, or of kind of displaced, but they exist completely. And you could say it's based upon an elitism, an elitist form of community, but that has nothing to do with one's financial background or their intellectual background. It has much more to do with a certain kind of inclination, or perhaps you could say a willingness to play a game, which isn't the game that belongs to, you could say, to contemporary art or to an art market.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of incarnation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or game. That's my experience when you just perform. It's a kind of game, how you put together some different forms of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yesterday you started a story with talking about Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in Berlin?
You mean in respect to what did what
to the story?
What did I actually do in Berlin?
Mm-hmm.
I searched daily for oral histories. I basically, the histories that my parents presented me orally, that is, I searched, and I tried to attain them, to grab them again through oral contact, through saying, "Excuse me," to a passenger, "Did you know about this? Could you help me?" And not to say that what I was doing was perhaps preaching an alternative history, or what you could say the traditional, very common artist strategy to create this oral myth or this urban myth. You know, it wasn't about trying to conflict notions of, you could say, accepted history. It was more about saying, excuse me, do you know where this train station is? I say, yes. He said, how long has it been like this for? And they say, well, since the war. And he said, all right, do you know if there's a tunnel that relates also like with the train station? They say, I have no idea what you're talking about. And you say, okay, the next person. And as it continued my daily questioning of very specific parts of Berlin, it became more and more interesting, because most of the people didn't know what I was talking about. But then again, what they told me, what they knew about these things, I had no idea about it either. So it was very much reciprocal. And so they learned things about my interpretation of a particular history, and I learned about theirs. And then at the end of it, I took the oral stories from my parents, which I always said my mother's were anecdotes and my father's were tales, and I combined the two to create a narrative which basically ended in a story. And that was basically what I was doing in Berlin, was strolling around asking people questions and video recording, photographing, and compiling, you know, a project out of this experience.
Hmm. And after Berlin, where did you go then?
I returned back to Scotland, and then I basically began working on a new project, which was called Photography as My Punishment. And it was, that's still in progress, this project. And this one's, it's in relation to Tristan da Cunha, the world's most remotest, well, I guess maybe not anymore. I'm not too sure how they, I think it's going to be one of the world's most remotest islands. But Tristan da Cunha has 276 inhabitants, apparently. And this is a project called Photography is My Punishment that I'm still working on. And that's what I began working on. And then it kind of sped up very quickly, and it turned into other projects, one in Leipzig and then the project in Paris. And I've been working on that in Glasgow. And only now for the last 5 months, I've now been living in Germany. And only in Germany, I've not really been making new work. I've just been perhaps dealing with the presentation of these previous works.
Mm. Und es ist an jedem Ort ein ähnliches Vorgehen. Paris.
Mhm.
Wachtleier. Mhm. Also ist es auch wieder die Geschichten der Eltern sozusagen durch Fragen versuchen zu rekonstruieren?
I think on one level, my parents played a huge role in the construction of many of these projects, but only with the idea of inception. They sparked it, but thereafter it was my job, I believed, to embellish the narratives or simply to question. So, for example, if I said, why was I born here? My father gives me this strange answer, which is, ask Henri Chopin, and he loves quailers and lives in Paris. Now, I can either embellish this narrative, which is equally as interesting, or simply I could question. And if I question that automatically is a question of my origins, my autobiography, which in itself is also interesting. So in one respect, they only started it off. They only kind of, you know, flipped the coin in the air and said, here's one interpretation, take it or leave it. And I took it and said, okay, now am I going to embellish, or am I going to question? And I did both. I questioned and embellished. And that's what happened. And I think with all these projects, they're only starting points. And then I, with serendipity, I love this kind of this idea of chance and of collaging many different kind of objects and possibilities or monuments and histories. And then that's where the whole Paris and Quaelings and the Holy Grail and the Holy Quail and the Surrealists and, you know, all these different things began to get kind of weaved together. Like in Leipzig, choosing Leipzig was deliberate based upon the histories I heard about. So they all had some significance. It's always something from autobiographical situation, and then it was completely like a flower. It began to blossom only once I arrived in the place. So actually, it's very important not only for me to journey through text works, through conversations, through people's ideas and emotions in that respect of researching to collect this information. It was very important as well not just to remain hermetic and to be what you could say academic and deal with information. I needed to actually physically be in the locations that were discussed, for example, Berlin or Paris or Leipzig. I needed to go there. I needed to actually be there. And even if I did nothing, drank coffee, walked around, got pissed, wasted my time, I collected so much more that was essential in trying to return to continue to piece the puzzles together.
Mm. your mother were born in Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1945.
Mm-hmm.
So in what kind of family was she born?
I think they were very much... it's hard to tell really, because for me, my mother never really spoke too much about her her German family, really. So I always had to kind of piece bits of information out. And that's what happened, basically. I have anecdotes. I have very specific anecdotes that won't really reflect the nature or the identity of my German family, but it will definitely illustrate little kind of details of post-World War II destruction or of some of miracles or survival things that become like beautiful anecdotes, that the only significance really is a reminder of my present-day appreciation, as opposed to things that help me understand previous events. So, for example, she could have told me, well, my father was an architect and my mother, you know, she did this and my brother did this, and they, you know, 200 years before they moved to Berlin, they were Huguenots then, and they were living in France and they were persecuted. There could be this one kind of, you could say, chronological method of giving me fragments of my identity, but instead I never actually achieved those linear parts of my history. I basically extracted mainly by chance, or maybe just by comfort, really. That's what my mother decided to tell me. I had these little anecdotes about one day a cow arriving in the garden, and it was 1945, and then my mother was, you know, she was just having was water, and she was basically about to die. And then one day they found a cow that became disorientated by the bombing. This is in Berlin, Steglitz. And the cow basically was thrown to the garden, and they had an aunt called I think Tante Inchen, and she saw, and she used to work on a farm, so they tethered her the cow to the wall, and for also almost maybe a year they used the milk from the cow, and they managed to survive with the cow. My mother survived. So these are the kind of things that that I was given as information. So it's different. So I couldn't really answer what kind of family they are, but I could tell you many different beautiful anecdotes, and also many of them that become very kind of sad and tragic as well.
Yeah, it's really difficult because we have always this difficulty to have a narrative of a or an idea of a current life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do life history interviews, we have that problem that it's always a big effort for people to narrate something like that life in a current form.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always something where so many things are left out in what probably a work could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we have now here in Frankfurt a situation that Santiago Sierra is doing this work, punished people from the second World War generation are standing around in different places being punished.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say this is the right form, or is that a kind of aesthetic form for this für diese Auseinandersetzung mit dem Zweiten Weltkrieg, dem Holocaust, zum Beispiel.
Is that are you questioning whether I think that's a good method to deal with these histories? Is that?
Yeah, probably as an artist.
I mean, in one respect, I think it's I'm appreciative of that. In that, in preference to making work that is perhaps wholly indulgent, or perhaps more or less, you could say, completely and kind of aesthetical, you know, candy. I think it's better that he, for example, there are these projects that are being performed that deal with perhaps histories in different ways. What I think is good about that kind of work is that it's based upon rumor as well, and based upon a certain kind of displacement, that you can just move through streets and pick up completely different interpretations of what's happening, and it doesn't actually have anything to do necessarily to an art community when it's also in any street corner, and it could also embody many different kind of perceptions of cultural or perhaps personal guilt or history. So I think that is good, and I think it's a very dangerous thing to do when one's career is always going to be looked upon in such a scrutiny. So I'm sure that, you know, based, and also the recent project with the car fumes and, you know, the synagogue, I think there are these projects that I'm sure that what he's doing now, what in this, put the recent one in Frankfurt or with the art fair, it's hard to separate with the recent thing. So I think maybe perhaps there is it's been sullied or tainted, perhaps his efforts, you know, I think sometimes those things can really distort the work, but fundamentally I think it's quite an interesting project, and yeah, I think it's good to still as an approach, you know, to question such things through performance as well.
Mm-hmm. And have you heard about this social psychologist Maurice Halbwachs?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book. It's called Collective Memory,
mm-hmm.
And this is probably some of these ideas. You have a kind of collective memory in the objects outside, mm-hmm. in the streets, in how you remember, maybe the environment.
Mm-hmm.
This is built into a memory, a collective memory. But would you say that if you work with objects, presenting an apple,
mm-hmm.
What kind of quality has this apple in Paris or in Stockholm?
I think that what I think was really important was that even though, for example, the project in Paris dealt very much with these monuments along the River Thames, these fish monuments that relate to the Temple train station and Templar Knights, and Temple Knight history, and then perhaps to, you could say, historical interpretations of what they did with, you know, with translation and gold and their wealth and power and et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, I think that it's the apple is very much a contemporary form of monumental history. It's a contemporary form that's personal. And the fish they're a historical form of monumental history that also have a right to be there and ought to be there. But if I were just to take all the, for example, St. Paul's Cathedral and take what that stands for, all the fish monuments, if I take these things that are presented in a social infrastructure, you could say contemporary social infrastructure, if I take them and use them into my own narratives and basically ignore the importance of the personal monuments of a present journey, I think there's an imbalance that doesn't really do me any favours. I think to have a balance between an apple that in some ways becomes an organic monument of a journey made in questioning a fish monument, that's really important, because not only does that, it's like a lubricant, it keeps the journeys going, it also keeps the sense of humour going. It keeps the sense that, okay, this guy's not actually really trying to find this man of an earnest respect, this guy's not a sad character who's also lost. It also says this guy's actually someone who's got a sense of humour and also who eats an apple because his French is so bad, but also he knows that apple is biblical in some terms as well, and that also has another narration to French and the Holy Grail and the Holy Quail and the Surrealists, also relates to the Surrealists and the Templar Knights. And you think, okay, so every different object, they have their own kind of their own history, their material history, but at the same time, some of them work completely on a sentimental and personal level, and then as perfect lubricants, they carry more or less landmark historical monuments such as St. Paul's Cathedral or the River Thames. So it's like a music score or something. It's really important. They're components, like a puzzle, that if it was too, otherwise it'd be too heavy, I think.
Mm. And yesterday you mentioned, to come back to that media situation, that the media, radio, that it destroys in a way a performance because of this loss of emotions. Do you need this intimidate?
I think, yeah, I mean, it is important, and it's not to say that that it's something that that's sincere. If I sit in a, for example, if I sit in an institutional space and I perform, not to say that's a form of perhaps of emotional or intimate exchange, but I think it really does. It shifts not only the meaning of the work, but it also, one thing that is definitely in question is the fragility of it. For example, the project is, it's very delicate and fragile. Now, if I kind of funnel it through a medium such as radio, it completely shifts what you could say the essence of it. And at the same time, things like repetition or these performative kind of approaches can easily be executed and used very well through something like radio. But things such as a personal, sentimental, or a very kind of fragile narrative or complexity can only be spurned upon and developed basically through an engagement with someone who's also reciprocating that. Because for me, anyway, I think it's difficult to perform something where your goal is in some ways a microphone and a mask in front of you, and you have a kind of a collection of different ears, and it's different, and in that respect it's not at all rewarding, and it questions in some ways a huge kind of relationship between biography and fact. Because in the project, one thing that's always in question is this notion of fact. And even though I hate that, because I think that in 2006, artistic approaches that question notions of fact and fiction, if that is what I'm doing, that's not interesting, because that's always been a discourse. But it's always inherent, I think. It's completely there, this idea of fact and fiction. And if you bump into me in a train station or on a bus or strolling through a gallery and I perform this story, there is always a framework. The framework is the bus, or the framework is the gallery. But the point is, the framework does not make a specific kind of relationship to my biography. It doesn't say, on the bus, between these hours, Tris Bonne-Michel will perform a story to you. So I think it's important that the biography is released from the framework. But on a radio, the biography is completely placed within the framework of the radio and then communicated. And that's what changed it, because fact in relation to biography, if I'm telling facts, if I'm telling a story on the radio, my biography is related to the facts. And when all these different forms of the project, such as the light, the visuality, details of sound and nuance of picking up objects and, you know, calendar collages and everything, if that's removed, one thing is intensified, and that's the words. And that's intensified, and then it's broadcasted. In that respect, the words have a greater kind of weight when it comes to fact. And in some ways, people always want to have some fact. It's like an awkward desire that many of us have, and then this kind of, the importance of fact is kind of is overblown, and that distorts the work, because fundamentally the work will always judge fact and fiction, because you never know whether I'm actually performance, you know, this is actually saying this is me performing, whether it's live art, whether it's installation, whether this is actually anything at all, whether it's just me casually telling you a story on a bus. And I think that that's the thing, is that that notion of fact exists. The interesting part of fact fiction exists also in the physicality, in the real engagement of the work. How does this story come into your life? So that's, and I like that. But then the radio, that notion of fact and fiction of how do I come into your life, it's gone, because it's obvious. I come into your life because you're driving a car and you listen to Radio X and you switch it on, you hear it, and then it's the bang, and you say, okay, who did that? That was this guy. Bang, it's over. It kills it in some ways. It completely kills the essence of it, because that relation of fact and fiction between human contact, because something more communal, is completely killed off, and then it kind of amplifies the importance of fact, and it changes it completely.
But if you have in mind when you're speaking or communicating in the radio that there's someone outside and you're speaking to someone outside,
yeah,
this is a kind of imaginary audience, but. I don't know, Walter Benjamin did that when he did in Berlin radio shows. Mm-hmm. It was this idea to communicate to children and to speak to children.
Yeah.
So maybe this could be a relation to think about a situation. What would it be possible to speak to children?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is probably one of the most kind of, perhaps for me, one of the most important things for me to do. I mean, I also try to work in kindergartens and do, you know, teach kind of 4 or 5 year olds like basic English to live in Germany. Parents want the children to be bilingual in some ways, or to do little art projects in primary schools, to do that in Scotland. And that's really important for me, I think. And I think that's one of the areas that I'm always striving to kind of to work within. So I think that is important, absolutely. But with regards to the radio, I think it is really good for many projects, absolutely. But I think for my project in particular, it just fundamentally went against many of the kind of the inherent qualities that I believe are important to keep.
We should play now some.
You're gonna from.
Oh yeah, I tried to.
Another music or.
No, we have left 12 minutes. 40. Yeah, I think it's the right time to play some of your performance from yesterday.
Okay.
But won't you think that radio is in a way incomprehensible? The media.
Is incomprehensible. In which respect?
That we probably not really able to deal with it in what it is doing with our emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would agree, but I think as well, only from my personal experience, I think that it is a great medium to use, but for me, I can honestly say that it doesn't really work with what I believe I'm doing.
Mm.
So, for example, this audio track that's going to be performed, that's going to be played, you can hear that, and on one level, you're collecting information, you're collecting narratives. But that's such a small part of the whole thing that it doesn't really amount to much, really.
And when would when is it possible that work can touch you?
I think that's basically when it's in a completely just, you could say, casual, interwoven place. When it, you know, it's by a pond, it's walking here, walking there, in a cafe. But it could also be in a gallery space. But it doesn't mean that it has to be proclaimed that it's in the gallery space. It can be in any space. But I just think that the framework needs to be right, and radio is such a framework as well. It has a framework, and that's what, at the moment, I have a difficulty with. Basically, I like that some works can be not only impermanent, but they can be completely switched on and off, and completely in between everything, and keep on going and growing. And yeah, but I still look for that kind of, you know, these kind of opportunities to storytell or to collect stories from other people. And it has nothing to do with art either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's listen.
You fucking idiot.
You fucking idiot.
Group orientation of the sort of, well, sound light shows and the sense of
sound light
togetherness.
Yeah. What do you think that feeling is when sometimes you have maybe an hour to spend in the house and you don't want to turn the television on because it kind of changes your consciousness? It's a little like when you come out of a movie, you can't really talk for a while.
Strange, isn't it? I've noticed people come out of the show, they're rather numb.
Yeah.
When they walk out of the show, there's very little conversation.
Yeah.
They seem to be abstracted, wafted off into a world of private experience. I think TV tends to be more social and less isolating than the movie. The movie tends to the world of the private dream.
It's funny that we wouldn't believe it, but we were talking about the subject of a beard while we were away, and I'm wondering if this sort of vague discomfort that I feel has to do with feeling that I'm not sure it's me sitting here.
You're afraid you're putting on the public?
That may be it.
Or
I don't know.
Taking him off. There is a strange expression, you know. You're taking me off. You're putting me off.
They both mean the same thing.
They both
thing.
Mean the same thing.
Yeah. How and, can it be the same thing and be opposite?
Baudelaire put it in that famous phrase of his, hypocrite like tout mon semblable, mon frère. Hypocrite, the hypocrite is a man who wears a mask, puts on a mask. Mm-hmm. And Baudelaire said, the reader is putting on my poetry and I'm putting on the reader. Mm-hmm. And it's putting on and taking off. It's consuming and producing simultaneously. It's their reciprocal relationships. But it's fun and games. This is the important thing. It is a process in which you play. TV demands play, hence dialogue and interplay. It's not a solitary monologue medium, and that's why people with a merely private image have difficulty relating to it.
I don't think of any politician who has a beard.
Finding Chopin, Search of Holy Quail. Sped up edition, Act 1, Lake District, Pencil Museum, Kirk Schwitters. Collections of sessions. Father says to me, Tris, give over your junk. Why? Get rid of it. Okay, translation, quick. What do I do? Sentimental value. Can I get rid of it? Okay, then what do I do? Construct. Camera, tripod, interval timer, 36 seconds. Exposure. Then every object. One object into gold, into next one. Collects Templar Knights. Translation, pure, and then over. And then one thing happened. Found my photographs. I said, hold on a minute, I can't just photograph and get rid of it and translate them into an archive from A to Z. That doesn't make any sense. But then I said again, why was I born where I was born? It doesn't make any sense either. So I said, hold on a minute, why was I born here? And he said, don't ask me, ask Henry Chopin. I said, who's Henry Chopin? Obviously, I'm from Fluxus, artist, surrealist, current Greek poet, basically a Dadaist. I said, okay. He said, he's 82 years old, lives in Paris, and loves quail eggs. So I said, okay, I'm going to search him, I'm going to find him. He said, Tris, you can search, but you can't find him. I said, okay, fine. So I began to search Henri Chopin in Paris. But then again, I realized one thing. I couldn't just photograph my photographs and translate them. So I made a detour via Leipzig. All the photographs of my past and all the calendars of my past, collected, put in a grillish green suitcase bought from Chilliwack, and then I flew out to Leipzig. At the same time, I knew I had to do something to these objects. So with a hand shredder, I began to shred every little photograph, and with tweezers and prick stick, make new collages from April until June. Same time from April to May, from April until May, April's Fools, upstairs at Laurent Hardy. Integration of football. Football is the way to get into a British culture if you don't belong to British culture. And then, the last one, was especially May Day. Day of Remembrance, what can I remember? No idea, so many things to remember in Germany. So what happened when the Nazis arrived? And they can applicate their ideology, through bottom and they're chasing them. At the same time though, they want to find me anyway. Another person saying, Nazis get out, fuck racismus. You know, this always happens in Leipzig once a year, as they try to storm there, kind of along the long street in Leipzig, down to the end of the monument from 1880, from the battle of all these kind of huge kind of warriors of the time where they thought that Germany was great. And I decided, once I made the three calendars, April, May, and June, June 22 by Picasso, and May by Van Gogh, 1888, and football at the beginning, Liverpool, 1997, integration. And then, from one moment, from one month, in solitude and confinement, of shredding and deletion and kind of liberation, I remember the last calendar, which was June. I began to search for Henri Chopin in Paris. He was also born in 1922, and every day I went around with bad French. Est-ce que vous avez le zouf de caille? Est-ce que vous avez le zouf de caille? Le zouf de caille? Est-ce que vous avez le zouf de caille? No one had something to say about apples. Instead, apples were good because they're kind of nutritional, at the same time they're kind of biblical, and also at the same time they're also pictorial. I said, wonderful. Walking around photographing lines, shapes, colour and forms, I said, yes, I can line into corners in buildings and everything architecture, and say, yes, this is also my kind of search and journey for kind of historiography. I said, well, this is fine, I keep on doing this. But then again, the apples always seem to go bad. I said, well, I need the apples, I need eggs, I need quail eggs, and I'm shopping there. I'll shop and they said, yes, I know who you are, I know you know. But I'm still Holy Quail, several nights in translation, trying to go into a piece of paper. I said, no, wait a minute, who's the Holy Quail? I said, wait a minute, the Holy Quail means nothing. But but I'm searching still, right? I mean, it means something. I mean, there must be some way to meet him. It's a kind of construct. It means nothing. The Holy Grail and the Holy Quail, there's no relationship between the two. Yeah, but there's a relationship between the ancestry of Onishopa and Templar Knights. No, but that was the whole thing, that kind of steady espionage story about, you know, the kind of idea that the bunch of kind of surrealists in southern France in 1922 claimed they had the Holy Grail. There's no relationship with the Holy Quail. But I believed it did, so I kept on searching lines and shapes to kind of form everything, like archive A to Z, boxes and lines and shapes and forms, put them away, and then kind of slide carousel, around and around, like a carousel, goes around and around and around, a visual narration, and hopefully somehow that will make sense, I can collate it once more time. And then again, I thought, wait a minute, I can't just bump into him, that's not going to do. Serendipity, I could always rely on serendipity, but not in this case. So I need a construct. So I return from Paris, with all these eggs. And then I get to blow, another translation. Blown out substance, like Humpty Dumpty. Once they blow too hard, they crack. Once he says too much, too many riddles, too many rhymes, he falls off and he cracks all the kings, falls on all the king's men, and comes back together again. Like tweezers and pritt stick, putting back together all the kings, all the Templar knights, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, putting back on a pedestal, or on a box, or a carousel moving around. And then, narrating something new. And around and around and around and around and around and around. And then I realize one thing, well, I couldn't just do this anymore. I have to give him the Chopin. He has to find me, he has to search for me now. So I decided, Christoph, 1998. Created Onishopa's last exhibition in Norwich. So I contacted him. I told him what I wanted to do. He said, come to Cromer, come to Norfolk. Tell us the story. I give the eggs on to him. So I decided, Ferrero Rocher chocolates, like Lübeck marzipan chocolates. I pass the eggs on, to the left, eggs, to the right, basically, shitty chocolates, but I always believed they were quite good. Ferrero Rocher, they always kind of get stuck to my tongue as well, and my kind of the arch of my mouth, but I knew that somehow, you need a gesture, a gift. And I thought it was nice, 24, the case, the paper, it was all beautiful. So I decided, I gave the chocolates as a present and a dinner, the Last Supper. The kids loved it, threw spaghetti at me. And then Christoph said, okay, I'll pass them on one day. Are you in a hurry? And I said, not really, but perhaps before he dies, it would be wonderful. And then at this point, I'm waiting and telling the story again and again and again, until perhaps Onishopa searches for me instead. Maybe he just finds the eggs and says, why they're kind of 20, 40 kind of quail eggs? It's quite nice, but I don't know what to do with them now. And what is the thing he's got to do with me? Then again, I realized in the Lake District, and then also Kirchwood's home, this kind of collage and obsession and collecting, made some sense to me. And my father said to me, Tris, you're going to be over the joint, you've got too much stuff, get rid of it. We're going to sell the house you grew up in, so I thought, how can I just do that? Since we had a value, but then Victoria, then another value, but then materially, they meant nothing, they were junk, it was crap, it needed nothing. Throw it away, skip, junk sale, couldn't even use it for a joint, you couldn't even throw it away in a bin. So I decided, translation, tripod, interval timer, around and around and around the camera, 36 exposures, 36 seconds, and then New object, slides, in an archive, place them away, A to Z, and then the objects themselves, threw them away. No problem, didn't need them anymore. And then the last one, I kept doing this until I found one thing, a box with my photos. I was also born in this street, which was also near kind of Clark's shoe store. So there's hundreds of shoe boxes always thrown out in the back. So I decided, okay, Clark's shoe store, boxes. I took all the boxes, put them in a crate, and now the crate's getting bigger and bigger, collecting more and more, and then it's destined for an island called Tristan da Cunha, hopefully. And if they accept me, the residency, I hope to ship the crate there. And then maybe I could also go there and stay there and translate formally the last thing, the physical objects, as shoeboxes, as chapters, and all the objects within as vocabulary, like in a visual vocabulary, like slides on a journey of lines and shapes and colours and forms. Or of a Van Gogh in 1888, he talks to his brother and says every line, every detail, every colour, every tone, of depiction and solitude, or of Picasso, of the Cubists, or anything. Somehow I can continue this some way. So I decided, I'll ship it away, translation, and then go to Leipzig, detour, and then translate the last thing with a hand shredder. Every little piece, little shards, again and again and again, shredding like the stars in 1989. They knew the war was going to fall. What happened was, they had so many files. All the machines broke down, and everyone stormed their corner and said, give me back my paper history. Give me my history back, that belongs to me. And this was kind of absurd in the same way that people knew in birth today, 31 people called the puzzlers, are puzzling all the little files together. They say it'll take 375 years. It's absurd. Like May Day, or April's Fools, for 1 month, in solitude, in Julia Omniev bedroom, translation again and again to the last calendar, only Chopin, 922, Picasso, 922. Do you remember when I went to Paris, going to search, lines didn't conform, around the restaurant, around, taking photographs, apples, bad French, again, it was okay, and I said, what are you saying, I don't want to say to my friend, I'm going to get lost, because I go, no way, have you got quail eggs, I don't understand English, there's a kai, and then I returned with three packets, just enough, I began a new translation of blowing out the eggs, took a long time, but at the same time, I knew that somehow, if I had 24, I can make a few full boxes of Ferrero Rocher, and then place in box, and then left, chocolates, on the right, Ferrero Rocher, and then I can put Christoph said, okay, come to me, Last Supper, have a dinner, tell me the story, I'll pass them on to him, I know Chopin, I'm still in contact. I said, you're good, because you know I can't meet him, he said, that's fine, don't worry about it, just keep on going. I kept on going, I pass him the eggs, I told him the story, and I'm waiting this point in time, and this goes around and again and again and again, and then at the same time, in the Lake District, Chopin said to me, Wait a minute. It's you. It's you, Triss. Why don't you just give me a ring? You know Eric's got my number. I said, yeah, I know, but, you know, fuck it. Gotta keep myself busy, right? So basically, that's where it lies. Around and around and around. Like a carousel that's stopped now. Or a home truce that's not going to be going on anymore. Like John Peel. Or perhaps at the same time like Henri Chopin, who's in a wheelchair and still performing. His last performance was in Glasgow. And he started off by, with a dim-lit room and table, and just started to kind of read out these abstract concrete poetry forms. Kind of like this. But he's 82 years old, he did this for 30 minutes. It was mesmerizing, but I wasn't there.
Okay, let's say goodbye. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft und Triss.
And yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.